Okay, good morning everyone. For those of you who don't know me, my name is Melissa Hale and I am the coordinator of Disability Advocacy Resource Unit. So thank you all for coming today. We've got a nice small group today, which is great because we can have some really good discussions about education and all the issues relating to that. So our forum today is being held on the traditional land of the Kulin Nation and I wish to acknowledge them as traditional owners. I would also like to pay my respect to their elders past and present and the elders from other communities which may be here today. I would also like to welcome those of us who have joined online. Just a reminder, if you would like to contribute to the discussion or ask a question, please check the number on the screen and I will read up the question on your behalf. So today's agenda will see us all back to school. Education was identified as one of the biggest topics of concern, trumped only by the NDIS. So today we'll hear from leaders in the field about some of the issues that are being faced by you all and what we can do about them. So before I hand over to Stephanie, a few little housekeeping things. The women's toilets and accessible toilets are at the front of the room on to my far right, and the male toilets are to my far left. There was another accessible toilet on ground floor. So lunch will be at 12 to 1 and afternoon tea at 2 to 2.30. We will have question time at the end of the presentation. So can you please make sure you put your hand up for the microphone as it's really important for the live streaming, hearing loops and other pieces of equipment we've got running today. So our first speaker today is Stephanie Gottlieb from Children and Young People with a Disability Australia, and she will present on progress towards an inclusive education for children and young people with a disability in Australia. So please welcome Stephanie.
Thank you, Nick. Oh, is this on? Yes, that's on. Okay. Thank you, Natasha, and thank you all for coming today. I just have to do this for 1 minute. Oh. You're bringing it up? Yeah. I think since it's a small group, I think it's a really good opportunity that we can have a discussion. I've certainly got a presentation that will fill an hour and I can talk a lot, but I think it would be a really good opportunity, particularly since we've got a small group, to talk about the issues as well. Getting back to school, I thought, you know, for some, you know, I was thinking that, and I thought, you know, for so many of our kids, it's a really anxious time, and some of them have been out of school for a long time, you know, so I just would like to acknowledge all the children and young people that I work with that have some really difficult, you know, times in accessing education. Now, my title is Progress Towards an Inclusive Education. Now, for children with disability in Australia and young people with disability in Australia. That's very positive, and unfortunately I really don't have a positive story to tell you today. There's positive parts of it, but we're not making huge strides, certainly in the opinion of the organisation that I come from, in progressing inclusive education. So I'm really keen today to have a discussion where we talk about the ideas that we have for putting a rocket up this. So interrupt me at any time with questions and we'll take it from there. Okay, just an overview of what I'm going to talk about today. I thought I'd give some of you an explanation of what CIDA does, so Children and Young People with Disability Australia. Some of you may know us, some of you may not. Talk about the current experience, what we know. Go through, and it won't take long, I can tell you, the policy frameworks and the major initiatives that are happening nationally. I've got certainly doing a national focus because we're a national organisation related to education and specifically to inclusive education. Other activity, one of the really good things that I have got to say is there's a lot of activity, there's a lot of noise about we need to do better in education. So we'll talk about that. Really great to have a discussion at the end about where to from here. Okay. Oh, sorry. And I apologise if I take a few pauses. I've had a bug or something, so I'm feeling a bit queasy. But anyway, So for those of you who don't know Children and Young People with Disability Australia, we're the national representative persons organisation for children and young people. So we cover age 0 to 25 years, so a big age range, and across disability organisations. So you'll see some national organisations that are diagnostic specific, great organisations, but have a slightly different role to us in terms of their focus. But being the representative persons organisation, it's absolutely about representing the direct experience of children and young people. So we do that as much as we can with children and young people, but we also do work a lot with families because I think it's 99% of children with disability live with families. And as you would understand, many of you young people are reliant, or young children are reliant on their families to speak, represent them. And their experience, but obviously that changes as the kids grow older. The direct experience is represented at all levels of our organisation. So on our board, it's made up of young people with disability and also families of children with disability from around Australia, and also at the operational level. So at the moment, we've got personal experience of disability on our operational team. I'm a mum of kids with disability. I've got four kids, two of my kids have disability. We've got young people that work with us. Hopefully soon we'll have some young people with disability that are on our operational team. So a range of ways in which the direct experience is represented in our organisation. And most importantly, we're a member organisation. We've got 5,500 members nationally, and our members frame what our work and focus is. You know, we do a lot of consultation. We speak with a lot of children, young people and families about what the current experience is. We reach out through social media, through surveys, through roundtables, a whole range of different ways, so we can really keep abreast of what the current experience is. And that then defines our work plans and our advocacy that we do. We're a rights-based organisation, so we're absolutely about progressing the rights of people with disability based on the social model extensively of disability, where we see the impairments, where we see the barriers to participation as being in the community, in the society, not due to an individual's impairments. And we've been around for a while now. From 2009 we started. We originally were auspiced by the Association for Children with a Disability in Victoria, but we've since, with the ratification of the Convention of the Rights with People with Disability, there was a very clear obligation for Australia to have its own representative body for children and young people on the national level. So we've, you know, gone through all that process and obtained separate funding. So we're funded through the Department of Social Services. We don't get a lot of funding, but we get some funding. I was hesitating then because I was going to say some people say you compromise because you're government funded. Well, the day that we tailor our voice to the demands of a government department or a government is the day we pack up the boxes. So, you know, we certainly need core funding, but we have a very strong role, which we take very seriously, about representing the direct experience of children and young people with disability. We're not for profit. You never know these days. It's a bit hard to tell, especially with this new market system, the NDIS. And for those wanting to know more about us, have a look at our website, hello, and we have quite an active social media presence. Probably our Facebook page is more up to date than our website, to be honest. Apologies for that. But we're constantly updating it with issues and the work that we're doing. Okay, so as I said before, our work is guided by the direct experience of children and young people with disability. And from when we've begun, from before we began, you know, as well. What did I do? Oh, what was that? That was, I didn't mean to do that. My son must have done that. I wouldn't be capable of intentionally doing that, by the way. The screen just spun around. So education has been one of the most significant issues of concern for children and young people with disability and their families. I don't often meet a family that says, what are you talking about, education issues? No, access and participation, haven't had anything happen that's out of the ordinary or that I wouldn't expect. Unfortunately, we have the opposite. Oh, I don't know if this is me. Oh, it's, okay. Okay, don't read that because I was looking at that last night and I thought there's a typo in there. It doesn't even make sense. So, you know, read it if you like. It will distract you for a while, but I'll just say at the start there's a typo. So what is common to us is very typical for students with disability, particularly in the school setting, is poor educational experiences and poor outcomes. Oh, this is fancy. I out-fancied myself. I didn't know I could do this. So what we have commonly reported to us is limited opportunities, low expectations, exclusion, inadequate resourcing. I don't know what I've done here. Inadequate access to expertise, so support staff, teachers, behaviour support, allied health. So often we have concerns raised to us about the professional development and the training and expertise of support staff and teachers, but also actually accessing additional things that you may need in a school or a child may need in a school. Bullying, very common experience, which I'll talk about later. Discrimination, and quite a remarkable kind of increasing incidence of restraint and seclusion. So, I mean, I wanted to emphasise too that we do, my presentation today is quite dark. It's not a positive picture at all, but we do have positive experiences and pockets of good practice that are reported to CIDA. You know, we think that's great, you know, or that, you know, we hear and we applaud, you know, when we hear kids having really positive educational experiences where they're excelling, they're doing all the things that we want out of a school, they've got friends, social, the whole thing is happening. And we meet with a lot of teachers, we work a lot with teachers who are doing outstanding stuff, you know, and you think, wow, this is fantastic. But what I would say about that is that the positive experiences are dependent on look, 99.9%, or actually I'd say 100% of the time, are really dependent on vigilant family advocacy. You know, where they're from day one, you know, or before day one, families have got into schools and really articulated what the specific needs are for the child, what the child's strengths are, and had no compromise throughout that experience. And I talk about, too, the stars aligning, and it is the stars aligning, you know, because we often it will be contingent on a principal that has fantastic social justice principles, or a teacher that has just had, particular expertise or a particular background or has a brother, you know, so they get it a bit better. Or the school is particularly rich or something and can, you know, it just really usually depends on a whole lot of things just falling into place. What we also see is that many families who don't talk about their education often think it's just part of the lot of having a child with disability, having low expectations, thinking, you know, my child won't go to school and learn how to read because he's got a profound disability, so therefore it's okay if he goes and has a educational program where it's about eating yogurt and community access and all those names that we hear. So often then, because that's an expectation, low expectations are deeply embedded in our society around disability. You just kind of think it's part of what you do, and you don't. Many families don't question it. You know, they think it's okay for their son or daughter not to go to swimming, not to participate in the school play, you know, to go part-time. I can remember when my child started at mainstream school that we would get calls, you know, saying, oh, he's a bit tired, can you pick him up? I'm thinking, oh, okay. And to start, I just thought, oh, I better go and get him then, you know. Then I thought, what? You know, but some people think, well, that's just, you know, what you do. You just go with the system. And there's, you know, coupled with that, we see a lot of assumed expertise in the education system. So people will present to their local school and, you know, a principal will tell them what is really best for their child is that they go to the special school. Might be 12 k's away, might not be where any of their siblings go, might be not where the child wants to go, but there'll be this expertise that's where her needs will be best met, you know, and it's based on nothing, you know. So people often just go with kind of the inadequacies of the education system. What is really important, which I want to talk to you about later, is the positive experiences are transient, you know, they're not becoming embedded in our system, and we're thinking, okay, things are really getting better for kids with disability and our system is becoming more inclusive. You often go back to a school 5 years later, the principal's changed, the student may have been a formidable advocate for disability, and it's a whole different scenario. And so we'll say, go to, I'm making this up, Blackburn North Primary, don't even know if that exists. They're fantastic, you know, they've got a great rep that we've had. And people go there and went, what? You know, we were told don't even bother enrolling, you know. So it's really, you know, what we're seeing is when there's really good practice, it's not getting cemented in. I really have to get my son, who's doing screen media, to have a look at my PowerPoint presentation, I think. I just wanted to remind people that we all talk about it, the right to education. It's a right to an inclusive education. I haven't put the whole part of there down there, but we seem to overlook that. I just think it's really pertinent that we remember that. Now, I'm not going to talk a lot today about defining what inclusive education is. Years ago in 2013, we did an inclusive in education towards equality for students with disability issues paper, which talks about, we know that it's equal participation, opportunities and the valuing of students with disability. It's also defined very well in the general comment number 4 relating to inclusive education of the UN. But I would recommend, if people are wanting a great resource, if you haven't seen it already, it's our best seller. We don't sell it, but you know, we've had this downloaded since 2013 when we released it. There's been hundreds of thousands of downloads of it, so that's a really positive thing. There's obviously a real thirst to know more about inclusive education and what it's about. So it did a really thorough literature review of all the research, around, some international as well, on inclusive education. It discusses the considerable body of evidence that demonstrates the benefits of inclusive education for all students. So when I say all students, I mean students with and without disability. So what we know very strongly from this paper is that inclusive education provides the best outcomes for students with disability over and above segregated education opportunities. Obviously, it's a rights-based approach. If you're wanting a copy of it, you're most welcome to... I've got a few here today. You're most welcome to contact us, or you can download it. And that's just flicking through what's in that paper. Okay, how are we going for time? All right. Okay, so I thought now we'd talk about what is actually happening in relation to education and what we do know. From the From the start, I'd say that there is limited statistics. Things have got better with a nationally consistent collection of data, but limited national statistics. So it's really hard. We've got this, which I'll talk about in a minute, an overwhelming body of anecdotal experience. Direct experience is very strong that our education system is failing to meet adequately the needs of students with disability. But the statistics, the formal statistics are limited. So, I might have gone too far. Did I go too far? Oh, I don't know. Anyway, so just in your mind, so we've got about 8% of children and young people 0 to 24 who actually experience disability. Looking at the year 12 completion rates, now this is 0 to 65, so we need to take into account that generation gap, but there's still a marked disparity when we can get the statistics around, the statistics available or the numbers available are around year 12 completion. And again, the difference in tertiary degrees are quite marked as well. So 17% of people with disability have completed a bachelor degree or higher compared to 30% of people without disability. So a really marked difference in where people are ending. What we've seen, there was some statistics released last year, discussion analysis of them, and they showed some really interesting information. And what they said was that the students with disability, there was more students with disability attending special schools. So that had gone up to 15%, whereas in 2003 it was 11%. The other thing that those statistics said, which I haven't put up there, is that there was a move away in mainstream schools from the specialist classrooms. So those separate units, those separate classes, specifically for kids with disability, there was actually a decrease in the number of students who were, that was their form of education. So whether that means those kids are now going to special school or those kids are in the main, it was difficult to tell, but I thought that was really interesting. And again, that could be a positive sign. I don't want to be all gloom and doom. What we also saw is that an increase in the number of students with, now this is not my language, I just want to clarify that very quickly, severe or profound disability limitation, I mean goodness who speaks like that, attends a special school. So that had gone up from, it was 26% in 2015, which is the latest data that we have, but in 2003 it was 22%, which is a bit strange given that, you know, we've got a Convention of the Rights Convention of the Rights of People with Disability that clearly says inclusive education is a right. So we're going backwards. I wanted to mention bullying when there's no national kind of official data on this around students with disability, but it's very common. I'm going to talk to you about what we found in our survey, which is shocking, in a minute, but I just wanted to talk about, I think many of you would have seen the fantastic Held Back report, 2012 I think that was released, which really, that showed that students with disability were three times more likely to be bullied than the general population, and two-thirds experienced bullying or harassment. Now, the figure for kids with disability, or kids generally, is 27%, you know, which is shocking in itself. But I don't know why our kids, I mean, I do know, but there's clearly a very significant issue that we're seeing this type of discrepancy. So, we started doing a national survey in 2015 and we've had really fantastic responses to that, and it's always been kind of very representative of the different states and territories. Now this is an exclusive for the Daru workshop because we haven't released any of this data until to date because we've been analysing it. But the results are no surprise to students and families, but they've been really important. They've showed some really shocking experiences, but they've been really important in giving us an evidence base to go to the wider community, to go to politicians, to go to the media and say, look, this is what's happening, here's the figures, you know. You don't like our figures, do your own figures, because I bet you $1 million they'll come back the same. Okay, so last year we had, it was a bit down, usually we have over 1,000, but we had 766 participants. Some of them were students directly and some were families. We don't let service providers participate in this survey. If they want to talk to us about education, they can do it separately, but this is really about the direct experience. So we had 68 of respondents thought the support received by the student was inadequate. 47% reported that families had paid personally for specific supports or equipment to enable access and participation. So that's things like, I'm not talking about additional extras, you know, like we want, I don't know, something very fancy for our child, but things that we would expect would be a reasonable accommodation. And looking, you know, if you look at the rights of children with disability, they've got a right to a free education, and the accommodations are meant to be provided. I was surprised by this statistic. 73% of students with disability reported having an individual education plan. I thought it would be much lower, because we certainly get a lot of reports decided that that's not the case. 38% of students were excluded from events or activities at the school in the last year. So camps, swimming, concerts, some classes. 56% had experienced bullying in the last year. 19% of students with disability had experienced restraint at school in the last year, so that's nearly one in five. You know, 21% of students with disability experienced seclusion at school, and we gave very strict definitions. I can tell you what they were, but they basically aligned with the Australian Psychological Society definitions. So we asked, you know, has your child experienced this, this, and this? You know, so we didn't just leave it open. We really defined what it was, and we came back with these shocking statistics. I thought this was shocking. I don't know the rates usually of suspension, but 17% of students with disability had been suspended in the last year. So I'm not sure why disability is being clearly seen as something to discipline students about, but it seems to me that, you know, there's something, oh, I know, there's something not quite going well. Here's some, we had hundreds and hundreds of examples of direct experiences. Now, I'll read them out. I wasn't going to, but I will. My son is currently doing open access at school at home due to bullying and being pushed to the ground at school by a Year 12 student. This caused a disc prolapse. So these aren't particularly extreme, but this is just what was reported to us. These are from last year's survey, but this is what we've had since we've started as an organisation. My child is allowed to attend 9 to 12:15 p.m. during the day, 4 days per week. She often gets sent home prior to 11 a.m., at least twice a week. The principal phoned to say that the classes were settled and they did not want to unsettle them with an ADHD child, and so no offer of enrolment would be forthcoming. So that gatekeeping is a very common experience where people are going to their local school and being told either directly or indirectly that the school doesn't have the capacity. Now, that's not necessarily a criticism of the school, because I think it's the reality in many instances, because our system isn't allowing adequate needs. I never get told about trips such as their annual Anzac Day tour or next year a trip to Canberra. I just see the photos of these trips with happy, smiling kids enjoying themselves, and I know my son was never considered part of the group. Segregated into a spot on the carpet, which was a black square with her name written on it in chalk. Excluded from inter-school sport because of behaviours. She came first in age group for running, but they sent the child who came second instead. Behaviours are in inverted commas there because I'm not, it's always open to interpretation. Cyberbullying, including suggestions to commit suicide. Oh, sorry, I didn't put them up. Apologies. Now, this picture is old. It's of a cage at a school, or an enclosed pen, I think it was called. But we had many, many, well, I would say at least 10 to 15 people report to us in this survey that their kids were put in cages, which was a surprise to me. But this one is old, and I think this one has gone, but just that's kind of quite typical. This is a fairly, this is very disturbing, fairly constant harassment from other students, verbal nastiness inside and outside of class, has had food thrown at him during lunchtime and has had the student intimidate him and follow him home from school. The student filmed his frightened reaction and uploaded it to Snapchat so other kids at school could make fun of him. And then I'm just going to put up, I'm just aware of time. Sorry, I have to go back. Oh, okay, that's just numerous examples of cages, Leah, which I can give to you, and seclusion. So what we found in these cases, certainly the bullying cases, when schools went in quickly and did what they did around responding to bullying and educating all students involved and were respectful of diversity, etc., etc., we saw really good results, you know. We saw that it was addressed properly. What we often saw, though, was that wasn't addressed well, and it then went to the student with disabilities seen as causing this because they're different, they're weird, at some stages they're called, and never being addressed, told to toughen up, all those things, which was quite very disturbing. Okay, enough of the direct experiences, I think. I wanted to talk around the national policy frameworks that are happening. So we do have the National Disability Strategy, which I am going to refer to, which has a very clear learning and skills section in it. And that is basically how Australia is meant to meet its obligations under the Convention of the Rights of People with Disability. And it covers all levels of government. So there's state plans associated with that where state and territory governments put in. But what generally in the disability advocacy sector has been is that they've found that the strategy hasn't been very successful. I mean, the minister at the moment has got a new disability and carers. Is it called disability? What's it called, Leah? I forget. It's a council, but its main task is to reboot the disability strategy. There's been no funding allocated to the National Disability Strategy, and when you read it, you think this is great. But what's happened is it's just become a tick box. You know, so we often see, like we've been involved with the department when they're kind of doing the implementation reports, I think they're called, and I often feel like we're looking around for stuff that we can kind of paste in, you know, or we get limited. We get asked to do a consultation with our members, but in the past it's been very limited notice. So we can't do a thorough consultation with our members, but then I feel, you know, so it's been very problematic in terms of the National Disability Strategy. It's nearly at an end, 2010 to 2020, and it's deeply disappointing because in the range of areas that it covers six areas for those of you that don't know, it's been very problematic, and how things have progressed is not clear. So that's our main strategy. We've had national reviews of education. So we've had commonly known as Gonski 1 and 2. Gonski 1, in a nutshell, they left disability and said, really substantial area, but it's too complex and too much work for this review. Go away and get a loading done and look at what needs to be done as soon as possible. That then led to the nationally consistent collection of data, which many of you may have heard, which is a good initiative. It is problematic, and I think it needs some refinement. But it's around all schools across Australia identifying students with disability, so we're getting some better national data. NDIS, I have to say the NDIS, I think it's really important that we know that it's not the magic wand, and I think with the inadequacy of our education system, that we can't then say, okay, if my child's only going to school part-time, we'll just get the NDIS to fund a home tutor. Well, they wouldn't do that anyway, but it can't be kind of the fall gap for an inadequate education. We have to stay strong in demanding that there's progress made in providing a quality education for kids with disability and an inclusive education for kids with disability. And there's been a number of state and territory inclusive education policies. I think some of them are very problematic. The Victorian one, for example, has special schools in it. They're segregated settings. They're not inclusive, you know. So there's parts of it that are okay, but there's parts of the policies that are happening that are not okay. Queensland, I've looked at the draft Queensland Department of Education one, and that's looking really good. It's based on the UN general comment of inclusive education, and that's not out yet, but I was really pleasantly surprised to read that. Okay, I just wanted to touch briefly on the other activity that's happening in Australia, apart from the policy initiatives. Actually, I'll just go back, because I didn't mention Gonski 2, which is now happening. Sorry, I skipped over it very quickly. It's called Achieving Excellence in Australian Schools, which I think has some relevance to us because it's all about, well, how do we spend money using evidence base. The reports are due out in March, but unfortunately there was really limited opportunity to contribute. We haven't been met by the review panel. Sorry, I need some water. And also the submissions, I think from memory, they could only be 3,000 words, which really, you know, gave us limited scope. Okay. Now, just to go back to the other activity. What Australia has is a really positive. We've got some of the most phenomenal inclusive education academics that there are on the planet. you know, and I don't know if any of you have seen the All Means All online group, which is about inclusive education academics. I think you can join as a parent, but certainly as advocates. But some really, you know, you would have heard them speaking out, you know, and I know a lot of them, you know, I won't say names because then I'll miss some out, but we've got a very strong, reputable, formidable body of expertise that is Australian that can really... So we've got the expertise in Australia to actually make inclusive education happen. You know, there's no doubt in my mind about it. You know, they're very committed to getting change. Social media has happened, like it's really changed in the last 10 years. So we've got a lot of agitation about between families, between advocates. You know, sometimes it's not all nice, but let's be nice, guys. We can have a difference of opinion. But a really much stronger voice and ways of communicating around what's happening and what our rights are, what the kids' rights are, you know. That's very, I think, a real positive, and we need to work out how we can use that. I think we are using it effectively, but keep using it really effectively so we can get the national campaign that we need to around progressing educational rights. Great work happening by many of the state organisations, other stakeholder groups, lobby groups. You probably would have seen many of them around. Obviously, state organisations like WIDAS, WIDAN, Julia Farr, Association for Children with Disability, and there's a couple of different ones in different states, but also lobby groups, you know, like Tasmanian Disability Education Reform Lobby. You know, they're pretty much a lobby group of parents, and phenomenal work, and really adding voice to to a really growing awareness of that we need to do better in education. Okay, there's been numerous inquiries. I'm not going to read these out. Leah, these are, I think, 4 or 5 pages of the submissions alone that CIDA has contributed to just in a 4-year period. So I'm on to page 2 now. They're either directly related to education or relevant reviews, which we've really tried. We've actually gone full on with this because we actually wanted to get disability on the map. Before it wasn't there, you know, or was there, but we wanted to get it really firmly on the map and a key consideration. Still going. That's why I've got black circles under my eyes. Still going. Okay, finished. So lots of inquiries, but still, you know, we've had a lot of inquiries. So we're talking about a lot more, which is positive, but still we're getting these poor experiences reported to us. So a range of stakeholders. The other thing that I think is really positive is that a range of stakeholders, have clearly said we need to do better in education. So CIDA's worked really hard, and other organisations have too, around developing the networks a bit wider to talk around what's not right with education and students with disability. So we've done lots of stuff with the unions, parent associations, and there's a real want to do better across a range of organisations. You know, ACOS, or VCOS, we're here today. So other people are saying, are actually getting a greater understanding of the direct experience of children with disability, and shouting out that this is not good enough and the right to an inclusive education needs to be recognised in Australia. Lots of media, and I really wanted to talk about a little bit about how media has changed a bit. And I noticed a couple of years ago when we were working with a boy, Tate, I can see he's in the paper, a great young kid who'd spent most of his school days in a cupboard in Harvey Bay Primary School. And for the first time ever, I usually have to do interviews, and I've done a lot of interviews, and Leah can talk to this as well, but where you have to explain, well, why it's not okay to restrain a child, or, you know, justify why a kid with a disability should have a quality education and not be treated like an animal you wouldn't treat an animal like that, like in these disgraceful ways. But what I saw then, and I have seen in recent times, although on the weekend there was another incident which made me think, well, hey, we've still got a way to go. But certainly much more of a message in the media that this is not good enough. You know, before that it was yes, but kind of what else do you do, you know? But now there's a real change in the media, which I think, you know, many of us as advocates have helped create. So there's been lots of positives, but despite all this, you know, the direct experience is not radically changing. Still the experience of an inclusive education eludes most students with disability. So the way forward. Got some ideas, guys? I have. I just want to quickly say that the UN General Comment number 4 on inclusive education clearly articulates those issues as well. If you haven't read it, I would suggest that you do read it. If you want to contact me, I can steer you in the right direction, but you can find it I haven't put a link up there, apologies. But it clearly articulates a way forward. It doesn't say close all special schools tomorrow. It talks about a progressive realisation of inclusive education, but it includes everything that we can think of and that we will say today, I think that it would include. But it clearly talks about having a national, that parties, so Australia as a party to that, so a signatory, needs to have a national strategy for inclusive education. My proposal what we're planning to do as the national organisation is to actually write the strategy for the government. We're going to be reaching out really clearly to a range of stakeholders and advocates such as yourselves and kids and students and say, here's your strategy, there's no excuses, implement it. But I, you know, but I am really interested in your, that's a lot of work and we've got a limited capacity, so we're going to need lots of support. But I, for me, we just, our wheels keep spinning. You know, I've got, for my own, you know, other people can speak to this, but my kids are 18 and 19 now that have a disability and nothing has changed in their schooling. You know, like there's bits around the edges that are changing, you know, and they've both had inclusive education, but riddled with compromise and riddled with poor experience at different times as well, you know, and they're in a very fortunate position. But they're still just, you know, I'm interested to hear from you now as to questions and what you think is the way forward. You've got to at least come up with one idea each, or you can't have morning tea or whatever's next. There's lots of things to that question. I think the most one is around the funding model that is now being proposed with this new disability loading, which we're still yet to really see how that works. I don't understand, and I've got a pretty good understanding of public policy, what that's going to mean on the ground for kids with disability. And there's been no, with that nationally consistent collection of data, that's all about developing a disability loading and more funding. But there's been no articulation of what they're going to do that is different with that money. And so for me, it's, I've done the funding applications myself. I've supported lots of families that have done that too. But really the fundamental question is, how is your school going to ensure that the educational needs of your child are met? It doesn't matter if they don't get funding or not, actually. Like the program for students with disability, they've still got the same legal obligations. Now, I know that Julie Phillips will talk to you ad nauseum about this in the next session, but I think we want more accountability for our children's learning. That's a huge issue. And at the moment, I think funding is absolutely critical to having a more if we're going to realise an inclusive education system. But the fundamental question for me is whether, no matter what kind of, because the funding is fairly arbitrary at the moment, you know, is whether you fit this criteria that governments have established. I was going to say made up. But really there's, they've got very clear legal obligations, which Julie Phillips will go through very extensively in the next session, I'm sure, where they must meet legal requirements to ensure that your child can access their education on the same basis as of a child without disability. And so the funding is really important, but for families, we have to talk about needs rather than not, I know it's really hard, but not get caught up in the dollars. That's not our problem, but they've got a legal right to provide.
Yeah, but you've also got families who don't acknowledge their child has additional needs, so they don't apply for funding, and it's almost like the funding pool gets watered down.
Those kids probably wouldn't get funding.
Well,
yeah, but around, I mean, you know, many kids don't get Program for Students with Disability funding. Many kids. But our education system still has the obligation to ensure that their educational needs are met. Yeah. That's up, you know.
And I think the kids between IQs of 70 and 90 really fall through the gaps in our education system.
Yeah, absolutely. Kids with dyslexia, you know. Yeah. And so the new nationally consistent collection of data is meant to address that, because that, if you have, I can give people more information if they want it, but it's around different levels of adjustment needed. So it's, and it's, you know, they've got from no adjustment up to extensive or substantial, but there's four levels of adjustment. So that should address that, but just that, to me, it's not really articulated well as to, well, what's that going to mean on the ground for families? What are we going to do? We don't just want more aids. We don't just want more of the same because it's not working, you know. So we need a really important, like some of the things that you were saying before around teacher professional development, around how we have better accountability for learning, a whole lot of things that needs to happen, you know. So if we know, I think why we all agonise over getting funding for, you know, specific disability funding for our children, the same, the schools still have the same legal obligations, and they need to, they need to be a child with disability, or any child, but for the children with disability that we're talking about, every school needs to articulate how their educational needs are being met on the same basis, and that, that they're getting the same educational opportunities as kids without disability. And I leave it with them. One of my kids only gets, he needs line of sight, hope there's people here from the education department today, line of sight support every minute of the day. I think he gets level 3 or 4 funding or something that they use with their criteria, which borne really no relevance to meeting his needs, and said, here he is, you sort it out. And they've sorted it out. So, you know, it's tough. It's tough. I think there's...
Stephanie, thank you for a great presentation. It certainly represents the grassroots experience from a family point of view. One of the things that we observe in our experience is that schools are not necessarily demonstrating and using evidence-based practice. And I think that can encompass all sorts of things. So the way they teach literacy to the way they manage behaviour. So a whole range of things. And I think sometimes it's not necessarily about resources, but about how the resources are actually spent. Mm. So to give an example, in our school, the principal very proudly told me that he'd spent $5,000 on readers, but they were readers that were actually not considered to be good in terms of them not being decodable for students who were struggling to read. So I think it's a complex question about resources, and I think in terms of accountability, it'd be great to see some checks and balances at a national level about governance, about how resources are spent, and the way that teachers are actually teaching as well. Mm. So we have in our healthcare system, we have very strict national standards. We have in childcare, in nursing homes, we have national standards, but we do not have the same standards in education. And I think actually something like that needs to be considered.
Mm. And again, you know, that is articulated in the general comment as well, but there's a really strong movement around that. And I think that also around the... We do have a really vocal group of really skilled academics, which we can link you into, but it's then how do you do it, and then how does the school have the capacity to do that? I can remember working with one school about looking at their use of classroom support, saying actually, you know, having someone glued to the child with a disability, that's not ideal, you know, and there's a whole range, and giving them they were very receptive to a whole range of research which showed that was questionable practice and, you know, probably not optimal for children's learning. And they were like, well, we don't know how we're actually going to have the capacity to implement this in the school, because we're going to have to change everything that we do. So that's kind of our role around why we want system, so it doesn't, and even if they did, it may happen when that principal is there, so, and then it changes back when a new principal comes. So that's where we're really keen to do some strong leadership and be reaching out to you very strongly around how we articulate this in a strategy so it becomes systemic. Because we keep doing patchy little stuff, you know, and the evidence base, I mean, our system is riddled. You know, there's a lot of assumed expertise and often with the best of intentions, but often causes not optimal outcomes and sometimes harm.